You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
I'm convinced that we will come to a final agreement in the course of this week, for the simple reason that we have to find an agreement this week.
Jean-Claude Juncker there, as the dialogue between cash-strapped Greece and its European creditors finally takes a positive turn, we hope. We'll ask what other countries have at stake across the negotiating table, such as Germany. My guests are Sebastian Borger and Roger Boys. Also coming up, NATO carries out exercises in Latvia, an attempt to flex its muscles near the Russian border and reassure the Baltic states that we've got their back. But do we really? And in more East versus West shenanigans, we'll head to Washington, where China and the US have been meeting this week to discuss everything from trade deals to alleged computer hacking. All that, plus the Norwegian chocolate bar that 90% of British people are convinced is one of its own. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Roger Boys, diplomatic editor of the Times of London, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome to you both. Another day, more developments in the ongoing Greek financial saga, which has seen the nation locked in talks with its European creditors in order to try to reach a deal that might avoid it running out of money at the end of the month. Today, news is emerging of new proposals that include higher taxes and welfare changes, plus steps to curtail early retirement in Greece. It's unlikely to go down well with Greek people, but what do those holding cards on the other side of the table, including Germany, make of today's developments? Sebastian Borger, the Germans, if this deal goes through, must be quite happy because they've got pretty much what they want.
Which deal? I haven't seen any deal. What we're now doing is we're looking at another set of papers handed over at the very last minute by the Greek government. And I mean... Juncker saying there'll be a deal by the end of this week, I think is preposterous. It'll drag on and on and on and on until people, particularly in Germany, realize that the Greeks will never be able to repay their debt.
Roger Boys, that's basically been the theme for the past 5 years, hasn't it? It's there'll be a deadline, which may be real, may be arbitrary. There'll be these papers, which Sebastian alludes to, and we'll then move on to the next crisis 3 months on. Is there anything to suggest to you that actually a deal which means something could be struck by the end of this month?
No, it's just a question really of whether Greece can pay back its... what it owes to the IMF, and for that it needs a deal with the European Central Bank, and to do that it needs to persuade people in the European Central Bank and European leaders that it's serious about reform. And of course it isn't really all that serious. It's produced a paper that, for example, seems to make concessions on cutting pensions, but the truth is, the truth is the government is led by not by a party, Syriza, but by a movement, a leftist movement, which is full of, crazed, kind of post-neo-Stalinists and who are probably not going to honour this. And
but
so,
Roger, this is, they may be crazed neo-Stalinists, but they're elected crazed neo-Stalinists, and they're elected after 5 years of governments which swallowed the medicine of austerity, which their European counterparts said they should, and look where we are.
Yeah, but guess what? The Germans got elected too, and the Slovaks and the Irish, and they've all been doing their sums, and they don't retire at 50 with 800 euro state pensions. We don't retire at 800 euro a month state pensions either, but no one's really asking us in this particular situation. No, we're leading, we're going, it's what's going to happen now is we'll buy time for the summer and then the same three options that have existed for the last 18 months will again reemerge. Either Greece folds or or Greece gets what it wants, in which case there's going to be a revolt in Germany.
And in Ireland, or in Brexit. Portugal.
Yeah, and in all sorts of places, that are actually poorer than Greece, like Slovakia. So, or there'll be a Grexit, that's to say Greece will leave. And each of these three options leads to some kind of systemic disaster for Europe. So it's great. Fun.
Sebastian, you mentioned something at the start about, eventually we'll realise that Greece can't pay its debts. If Greece was a company, we would have written this all off. We would have written off these debts years ago, because it would have been, except that, they can't pay off these debts, we'll have a proper haircut and we'll start again.
But Greece, that's the whole problem. Greece isn't a company because if Greece was a company, the company would have gone bankrupt and that's it. You can't do that with a country. And I mean, all through history, debt had to be forgiven. And we've got to realize at some point that there is no easy fault here or there. There is quite as much fault on the creditors' side who gave away these toxic credits to Greece through the 2000s. I think it's 175% of Greek GDP. Cut it in half, and we're at a manageable level. Every economist, I'm not an economist, but every economist I ever speak to says to me, it isn't achievable. It is not achievable. The Irish could do it. They proved to do it. The Portuguese can do it. They did it. The Latvians were really down on their feet as well, or on their knees as well. They did it. The Greeks will not be able to do it, whatever austerity medicine you'll give them.
So then why are we not talking about the creditors?
I mean, because we have too many lawyers in the German government and too few economists.
Roger Boys, Sebastian makes a reasonable point here, doesn't he? That it's all very well saying, the Greeks want to retire at the age of 50 and get their 800 euro pension, as you mentioned. But there were banks, many of them German, that loaned all this money to Greece at the same rates as they were loaning to companies in Germany. What pain are they suffering? What changes have they had to make to their way of life?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say how much pleasure it gives me when Germans say sorry, and it's always nice. And I'd like to thank Sebastian for that particular apology.
I don't have to apologise. The banks that have to apologise.
Well, and now we're at the hub of the thing. Do the banks have to apologise or not? Yes, perhaps so. But I mean, the thing is that the problem is not the Greek economy in itself. It's the fear that the eurozone will collapse, and because the eurozone is just an untenable. I mean, the euro is just an untenable currency. We knew that when it started. We knew that currencies, on the whole, have to be rooted in a nation state. And for a long time, the members of the eurozone pretended that didn't matter as long as you simulated a nation state with a European Central Bank and other elements. But that's going wrong, and it's this massive investment in a self-deception exercise. That's the problem. It's not really who lent money, who didn't lend money.
It isn't a bit, because otherwise we're having a conversation where it's just about the Greeks need to do this, the Greeks need to do that, and there is no discussion about how did the other side of us get us in this mess in the first place.
Why do you have to be so theological about this? Why does anyone really have to lash themselves on the back? What happened, and it was part of the structure of the way credits functioned and the way capitalism went astray. But the problem now is the self-deception that the eurozone can somehow survive all this and function.
I think my point on this is not that it's about apportioning blame so people can be lashed on the back, but if this is solely the fault of the Greek people, in inverted commas, then it makes sense that the Greek people should perhaps pay the price. There's a certain logic to that. But if actually part of this problem is that there were banks that made bad loans, and then governments in Europe that said, don't worry, we'll take on those loans, that surely, Sebastian, is
but,
an
I mean,
issue.
Taxpayers are paying for their government's decision to protect banks.
And there were people in Brussels who let in Greece into the Eurozone in the first place. Have we seen anyone going to jail for that?
And so, yes, it's not about who gets lashed on the back, but surely if we're talking about then what happens next and whose responsibility it is to take the pain, should it then simply just be the Greek people, would be my suggestion. Perhaps not, Roger.
But how does that solve anything? I mean, how does that actually get to the essence of the problem? Since the banks are currently not part of the Greek problem.
Because we bailed them out.
Yeah, because our governments that we elected bailed these banks out. Now we have to find some political management of this crisis, which doesn't seem... I know that Angela Merkel is virtually a saint now, but it doesn't seem to me that she has handled this crisis particularly well. I don't think that it's been politically managed, and that should have been brought to some kind of solution about a year ago.
Well, I can tell you one thing. The saint this week can't concentrate on the Greek problem anyway, because she's got a much more important visitor. The Queen is arriving in Berlin tonight, and the whole country will come to a standstill, and you could blow up the European Central Bank and nobody would notice.
Well, that's an idea. That's
Roger, go on.
There we are, the Queen of Europe and the Queen of Britain are both meeting. Sebastian, has there been, we've talked about this a bit before, the fact that, the German people aren't in any mood to make any sorts of concessions. And that has, in a way, sort of made it tougher to give Angela Merkel any sort of wriggle room. Do you detect that there is any room for compromise on the German side?
Well, look, she's dragged the German people along. And I have to differ from Roger in one aspect. Of course, he's putting forward the very old Eurosceptic view, which you may say has been vindicated. But, that doesn't help us either. That's 15 years ago. We are now looking at the question, do we want to keep the currency, the European currency, together or not? And she, I think, has taken the fundamental decision. Yes, she wants to, but she's got to take the people with her. And that's not easy. And, she's doing her very best, I think, to manage a crisis in a way which is, as far as I can see, the only way to manage it. Her predecessor, Schröder, was always talking about banging his fist on the table and getting decisions done and that. It doesn't work like that, particularly not with 19 other countries involved in the Eurozone.
We've talked about this endlessly over the last 5 years. And whenever I've talked to anyone who like yourselves, knows what's going on, talks to various people, they always say, well, look, it's probably going to work out because it has to work out. There's no way this thing can collapse because we really don't know what's going to happen there. Do either of you, both of you, sort of share that confidence that because, God, it can't collapse?
Oh, it can collapse. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. Mm. It can collapse.
And it's the people that say it's got to work are the Germans, because they've got the most to lose. But the fear factor that is driving the relationship with Greece is all these small countries dotted everywhere, countries that have pursued very, Nordic countries that have pursued very tough monetary policies, East European countries that joined the euro, like Slovakia, that joined the euro and made massive sacrifices. It's Spain, the Spanish government. If ever, if Greece thought that Spain was in some way an ally, it's certainly not, because it fears not just the contagion of a Greek exit from the euro, but the contagion of populism, left-wing populism. So so it's more than a German problem. So so it cannot be solved by a Wagnerian act of will on behalf of the German government or the or even the German finance ministry isn't on board anyway. But anyway, by Angela Merkel, it's not. It's beyond her now. It's not that simple anymore.
Okay, let's move on and to the Baltics, and in particular Latvia, where NATO has been undertaking a series of military operations aimed at showing off its military might on the Latvian border in sight of that old foe, Russia. The past few months has seen no shortage of stories lamenting the so-called new Cold War opening up on the borders of Eastern Europe. But after years of shifting its focus elsewhere on the globe and cutting spending budgets at the same time, is NATO's military clout, or the threat of it anyway, as fierce as it was when the Cold War was at its height? Sebastian, I think we know the answer to that, don't we?
Well, but even in the 80s, when the Cold War was at its height, we all knew that if the then Soviet Union decided to attack the West, you know, they would have been in Cologne within 2 days. So the military might of NATO was always the balance of conventional forces and obviously nuclear deterrence. What we're doing here is diplomacy, isn't it? With a few pretend weapons, we're basically trying to say to the Baltic nations, you are part of the West now, and we will protect you in case. How credible that is, I'm not sure, but it's obviously necessary. Otherwise, it wouldn't be done.
And that, Roger, is the problem, isn't it? Because we're saying this in theory, that yes, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, you're part of the NATO alliance, we're going to do these exercises, we're going to be there to look after you. But there was a poll a couple of weeks ago, that people in Germany, France and Italy saying, well, you know, if there was an attack in Estonia, I'm not entirely sure if I want to. I want us to go in there and help out. It's a fundamental problem, isn't it? Where it's almost as if the political class is a little bit further ahead than the populace.
Yeah, but I mean, if Russia invades, we're not going to have a referendum on it, are we? I mean, it is a political, governmental alliance decision. The areas of doubt come in are systemic. That's to say, do we activate Article 5, which is the collective defense clause of NATO, whereby we all defend.
One in, all in.
The Three Musketeers thing. If there's a cyber attack, for example, launched, that's to say, we don't know exactly who did it, launched on one of the Baltic states, or a bit of hybrid warfare. And this, then it becomes very complex. Do we put British soldiers, German soldiers at risk defending these countries when the perpetrator, although we all know it's Putin flexing his missiles, it's whether it's something, whether we can't pin the blame on him exactly, and, you know, what are we doing? Yeah. So it's sense of purpose, sense of mission, what's NATO for? And so what we're getting now is this slightly theatrical thing, reinventing NATO, saying, well, we were always good at defending the eastern borders of the NATO alliance, and that's what we have to get back to. But the truth is, you know, Estonia's got 5,000 men. If Putin wants Estonia, he can have it tomorrow.
And it's got something like 35 to 40% of its citizens speaking Russian and feeling in a way more Russian than Latvian or Lithuanian or
and that's the other problem, isn't it, Sebastian? That we may be in a situation where, you know, a la Crimea, it's not an invasion. It's, you know, a few hundred little green men who speak Russian and say they're local and they're just local defence forces. And, you know, these uniforms, they look quite new. We just bought them down the shop down the road. And ignore that tank over there. That's quite old.
Yes, I agree. Although, I mean, NATO only makes sense if we signal to Russia that, you know, why did we not want Ukraine in NATO? Because we didn't want to give that guarantee. There was a summit, I think 2008, where America was, the US were very keen for the Ukraine to,
and Georgia as well,
to apply and to be admitted to NATO. And I think it was France and Germany mainly, Roger will correct me, who said no. So that, you know, people were obviously for once thinking clearly about things. But we've got the Baltic states in NATO and in the European Union for that matter. So I think, as Roger quite rightly says, when it comes to the crunch, we've got very tough decisions to take.
Sebastian Borger and Roger Boys, thank you both. We'll be back with you in just a moment. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with London and with New York City. New York used to be such an easy city to crack for the visitor, but now its focus has fractured and shifted. Why not let Monocle help you to navigate it?
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Monocle has had a bureau in New York since its launch in 2007, and our travel guide is a celebration of all that we know and love about this place. We put together a list of the finest places and experiences the Big Apple has to offer, be it a cozy stay at the Cosby Street Hotel, a late drink in a classic bar like King Cole in Midtown, or a top-notch fuss-free trim at Cheese in Brooklyn. Let us take you beyond the obvious to reveal the hidden spots New York has to offer. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. So pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to New York in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Roger Boys from The Times and Sebastian Borger from Berliner Zeitung. Yesterday, the 7th annual US-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue Talks, there's a mouthful, began. They were aimed at building few bridges of cooperation between the two ideologically opposed nations, or perhaps diffusing a few misunderstandings at the very least. But the talks have got off to a frosty start thanks to ongoing accusations from the US that China may have allegedly been behind one of the largest data hacks in US history recently, the cyber attack on the US's Office of Personnel Management. Add to this China's insistence on building islands in the South China Sea, which the US is perhaps understandably not that happy about, and spotting any available common ground in Washington might be tricky. Roger, the cyber hacks in particular have caused some consternation in the US, haven't they? And it's made it a little bit awkward between the two nations, say the least.
Yeah, it's a very very intimate intrusion to hack the office, you know, the Office of Personnel Management. It's a kind of it's the human resources section of the American government. So anyone who's gone through security vetting, all the details are there. So if you've got mental illness or you use drugs, you know, all the things that you have to tell, tell in a positive vetting of by security sensitive to apply for a security sensitive job, all that's there, and they've got it. You know, now the Chinese may say, and they will do during these talks, no, we haven't. Yeah, but there are enough ways now to trace back where it comes from, a hack like this, and who's responsible, and it is quite clearly a Chinese intelligence operation. Now, what it's for, nobody knows. But if they can do kind of a reconnaissance hack like this, and this is why all sorts of things are going on, why they're testing all sorts of different systems, then it's very easy how that could elide into an actual, you know, full-on attack. So America's problem is is China just a big commercial rival, or is it a potential enemy and it's just having to shape its perception accordingly?
And Sebastian Borger, the issue that the US and to an extent Europe has with Russia and with China is that those countries are playing by different rules here, aren't they? They are willing to push in different ways, whether that is saying, well, you know, Putin saying we'll take Crimea because we know that the West isn't really going to stop us, or with the Chinese saying we're going to build these islands and we're going to secretly undertake these hacks because we know that when push comes to shove, the US isn't really going to do anything to stop us.
I think I'd make a difference between the territorial gains and cyber attacks. I mean, I was very amused to hear the State Department spokesman saying that there is room for better cooperation and better dialogue and more transparency. Now, more transparency, of course, goes both ways. Let's not pretend for one second that the US isn't constantly cyber attacking China and Russia and who knows who else. I mean,
the Chinese equivalent of the Office of Personnel Management probably wouldn't actually admit it if it did.
And to be honest, that's the point. That's the point. And to be honest, I'd be very surprised and I'd be slightly worried if they didn't. If they hadn't at least the same capability. But of course, we never hear about those attacks because the Chinese won't tell us.
I mean, if I might just add, a lot of the American anger is at the American government itself for having such outdated codes and not really respecting the confidentiality of the information that they've gathered from its citizens and its and government employees. So there is anger at America itself, saying, "Well, you know, we should have defenses."
Roger, is this essentially a meeting of the G2? And should the rest of us just accept that? You know, yes, we had that nice, you know, Sound of Music G7 the other week, but but frankly, this is where the real discussions and debates are happening.
Well, I think that there was a time when this was fashionable and people talked about Chin America, yeah, because of the dependency, because of the balance of payments, dependency of America and China. I don't think that works anymore, really. I think you are seeing increasingly that this commercial rivalry is spilling over into a competition between an insurgent power which smells American weakness and an American weakness that doesn't know how to cope with that kind of competition. So you're getting conflicts in the South China Sea, and you're getting a lot of testing, and it can be a test in all sorts of ways. One of them is hacking, of course. One of them is trying to understand China's strategic investments, which is something that concerns Britain too. I mean, should China be allowed, and how far should China be allowed to buy into the nuclear, civil nuclear energy industry in Britain is an issue. But it's not an issue that everyone's wanted to talk about because we've all been quite anxious to get Chinese investment. So these boundaries are now getting very blurred, and this is rather a dangerous moment, it seems to me.
Sebastian, where does Europe stand here? When the US is meeting with China at this level, is there, you know, Angela Merkel's meeting with the Queen, and that's lovely. But is there a sort of, do you think, a fear in Europe that they might just get left behind a little bit here?
Well, first of all, I question your use of the term Europe. I think Europe, first of all, stands divided. You know, you see that in the diplomacy, the visit diplomacy of European states people to China, and there's rivalry within Europe about who is Beijing's best buddy. I don't think the fact that they're talking in Washington is reason for Europe to be concerned.
We'll leave it there. Sebastian Borger and Roger Boys, thank you both very much indeed. If you're waiting for a Norwegian Kit Kat chat, sorry about that. That was Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamer Hoiveda. Williams, the studio manager, was Toby Hammond. Chris Lord will be here next from Istanbul. I'm back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.